It's that time of the year. Your vacation is coming up. You can already hear the beach waves, feel the warm breeze, relax, and think about work. You really, really want it all to work out while you're away. Monday.com gives you and the team that peace of mind. When all work is on one platform and everyone's in sync, things just flow. Wherever you are, tap the banner to go to Monday.com.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
The Michael Reid Show Podcast. Tune in weekdays from 9 on LMFM. To contact us, email now, michael@lmfm.ie.
Tuesday morning, the 3rd of January. Happy New Year and good morning, with much debate and a discussion from now till 11 a.m. This is Michael Reid on LMFM. The rotation of Micheál Martin and Leo Varadkar as a Taoiseach before the Christmas break resulted in a minimal cabinet reshuffle. The reshuffle of junior ministers, as you probably know, saw Thomas Byrne move from European Affairs to Sport, a move that will leave many of his Fianna Fáil colleagues envious of the Meath's TD, who will be given the opportunity over the coming months not just to line out with the country's victorious sporting heroes, but to effect change from grassroots level, policies that impact on children's participation in sport and create opportunities for them by shaping the direction that Irish sport will take at both an amateur and professional level. We'll begin this year's programmes with the Minister for Sport and Physical Education, Thomas Byrne. Good morning, Minister. Thank you indeed for joining us, and congratulations on your new role.
Thanks very much. I might just correct you briefly, Michael. Happy New Year. I'm not sure I'll be lining out our sports stars, but I hope that through government policy we'll be giving people the best opportunity of participation, and if they're at the top level, that we give them the best opportunity of reaching their highest potential. But I think it's a bit of a stretch to say that I'd be lining out with them.
Okay, I'm sure that's true, but I'm sure you'd be glad to stand beside them. What do you expect to be the biggest challenge for you in this new role?
Well, look, I mean, I was appointed to the role on the 20th of December. People are probably getting back to work like your own programme today. So I'll be meeting officials today, tomorrow, this week. I'll be visiting the sports campus, meeting Sports Ireland. We have offices of the department at Killarney. I'll be visiting them as well. Obviously, try to get read into the brief, see what the current issues are that are, you know, that will arise on the desk and will require decisions. But ultimately, I suppose what we're charged with doing as a government in relation to sport is, A, to increase participation among at all levels. It's not just about the elites, although they are really, really important, but at all levels to increase participation. We have a goal of a 60% participation rate in sports later on in this decade. Also to increase gender equality in sports. And there's a lot of work going on at the moment, and I think we have to bring some of that to completion this year. And also as well to include more minorities and particularly people with disabilities in sports. So Sports Ireland do a lot of the work through the national governing bodies, but the Minister for Sport has to ensure that these important government and societal policies are followed. And there's all the other issues with sport as well that you will hear about, particularly around the country. That's in terms of sports facilities and improving them. And that's something that I suppose every politician knows about, because every single politician in the country works on. And in my role, it'll be my job to ensure that that money is spent in a way that increases participation at sports all across the country.
Okay, there was a very interesting report from the Youth Stakeholder Forum for Sport before Christmas. At the beginning of December, 100 young people participated in this study, and you talked about participation in sport. Those young people have said that school uniforms are a barrier to participation in sport and physical education, especially when it comes to girls.
Yeah, I think, look, we certainly are listening to those young people. Obviously, I wasn't at that forum because I wasn't Minister for Sport at the time, but my predecessor was. And we're looking at what those young people are saying. I mean, clearly there are reasons for school uniforms, which I think most parents agree with. The cost was always an issue. But there's no doubt that, I mean, I even hear it from not just my daughter, and you say a lot of girls said this, but even my sons, in terms of PE, particularly at secondary school where they have to change or whatever, and maybe they don't have time for a shower, etc. This is tricky. So this is something that we'll work on as a Department of Sport with the Department of Education. I mean, in this country, traditionally, uniforms have been a matter for the schools themselves. But I mean, I think if we're going to increase participation in sports, we're going to have to listen to those who participate and try to address the problem. So I'm not going to give a commitment one way or the other on that issue, other than we are listening to those young people, and I will be reading in detail the report from that forum, which I think is very, very important that we hold.
But you have to convince boards of management. It's proved impossible for governments to influence schools on school uniform policy.
Yeah, I mean, that's really on the Department of Education side. I mean, what we have had in this country over many years, generally speaking, is that schools are independent and the boards of management, which are volunteers almost entirely, run the schools independently at local level. That's very important. But they would have, in many cases, very good reasons for school uniforms. And what we have seen at primary school level over the past number of years, I would say, is very much a move away from the old formal traditional school uniforms that we would have worn, mainly to tracksuits. And so we do see that at a lot of primary schools. In particular, we haven't seen that at second level. So this is something that we'll have to engage with the Department of Education, with schools, with governing bodies of associations of schools, etc., to listen to young people. I mean, the priority has to be, how do we increase participation in sports, and how do we do that connecting in the schools as well?
Because and how do you remove the obstacles? I mean, if girls are uncomfortable in skirts because of what they're doing or expected to do, well, then the problem is the skirt, it's not the girl, or if they're wearing white shorts and are having their period, it's the white shorts that's the problem.
Well, I think, look, I'm a father of a teenage daughter. I know all about the issues that they face, and I think uniforms are an issue. It's something that schools are addressing, I would say. But in terms of my role as Minister for Sport and Physical Education, is to ensure that we remove all the barriers to participation. And in fact, if you look at the government's national sports policy, I mean, the number two item on the list of actions is that we will work with the Department of Education to ensure that PE is delivered in schools to fully support the development of physical literacy, fitness in our children. And if school uniforms are a barrier to that, we're going to have to look at that. But they're not the only barrier. There's also the issue of physical education halls, playing pitches at schools, which is something I've raised before in terms of new schools that are built, connections with local clubs. And to be fair, the Department of Sport does a very good job ensuring that when sports grants are given out, that they are given out to clubs that work closely with community groups in their area, and particularly schools. We've seen Gaelic, the games development officers in various sports coming into schools. We see volunteers from clubs working with them. In fact, my own wife has volunteered with games promotion officers around schools. That's a really important connection with clubs. So there's all these issues that we can do, and we can expand to develop to ensure that we raise participation levels, that we encourage the people who are really, really good at sport. I think that's really important, but also we make sure that we include absolutely everybody. And that's a key objective of the government.
Yeah, and to become a good sport, because that extends out to every aspect of a person's life, doesn't it? If you have that sense of fairness and so on. But unfortunately, at a junior level, as children are taking to sports fields, we're seeing very, very disturbing behaviour by adults who are abusing referees and so on, and that seems to extend then into the players themselves as they get older, becoming violent, and you see these melees taking place, and everybody seems to be of the opinion that that's all right because it was a bit of a bust-up between heated players, when in fact it would be seen very differently if some of these fights or brawls took place on the streets of our towns and villages.
Well, I'm not sure that anybody's saying that it's right. It's not something that I would support. In fact, you know, it has to be stopped. And when I think we see what I've seen with referees in the last while, certainly, is that referees have found their voice. There's a lot of support from outside sport, from within sport, for referees and their decisions. And I've seen referees make, you know, very, very quick decisions when they're challenged unfairly or when they're abused in any way. Stop matches, give people cards, put them off, whatever it is. And I that's something that we absolutely support. But I don't think there's anybody out there that supports brawls or getting involved in them.
But nothing seems to happen. The guards are never involved. Should the guards be involved?
Well, if there's any violence on a pitch that breaks the law, of course the guardie should be involved. And I'm not going to talk about any particular cases, but as I understand, there have been one or two quite well-known incidents around the country that the guards have got involved in. So let's leave that to the guardie.
But there's been scores of others that they haven't got involved in.
Well, look, the prosecution of crimes is a matter for the Gardaí. What we've got to make sure is that referees' decisions are upheld, are respected. Referees themselves are respected.
Okay, but I suppose what I'm asking you about, Minister, is the ethos of sport, a sporting mentality, being a good sport and may the best team win. And that should be the attitude that everybody adopts if they're to participate in sport. And if that's not the case, how, as Minister, do you hope to change that?
Well, I think in general that is the case, but not everyone gets everything right. So people make mistakes, people do things they shouldn't do. That's what happens, that's life. But I think the vast majority of people and the vast majority of games are held on the basis that you describe, are held on a fair basis, are held on a competitive basis, held on a respectful basis, held, I hope, particularly the young people, on a very enjoyable basis that, as you said, gets people set up for life, gets people fit, etc. That's really, really important. So that's the way things are. Breaches of that are matters in the first instance for the referee and then in the matter for the national sports bodies, etc. And if there's breaches of the criminal law, of course, the guardie get involved. But I think let's start off on first principles, that games are there to be participated in and to be enjoyed as well.
Okay. Do you expect the joint bid by Ireland, England, Scotland, Wales and Northern Ireland to host the European Football Championships to be successful? Will it be something that will give a boost to the economy if it is?
Look, I mean, that would be very, very exciting. I'll be talking to my officials in detail about that this week. Already there has been preliminary government support for that, and I hope that will continue. This will become clearer later in the year. But clearly that would be really, really exciting. I mean, there's not just excitement for us, but there's a north-south dimension to this, an east-west dimension to it as well. I think it's very exciting. For the islands here as well. But again, it's something that is obviously very sensitive at the moment in terms of the next coming weeks and months. And I think before I start talking about specifics in relation to that, I'd like to sit down with my officials and make sure that we do everything absolutely right to ensure that we can achieve, support the sporting bodies to achieve success in that.
Okay. I'm sure there'll be a lot of support in the Rugby World Cup and indeed in the FIFA Women's World Cup, for that matter, for the players.
Well, look, I mean, it's a very exciting time for sport. It's a very exciting time for women's sport. And I say that, you know, coming from a house, my own family, where my wife is really the sports person in our house, not me. So I think that's very exciting to see the Mead ladies have done really, really well at a local level. And we see our women's soccer players as well reaching the highest levels in the world. And that's really, really exciting. I think there's going to be a huge atmosphere around the country during the summer for that. We're all looking forward to that and wishing the best. I mean, it'll be an intense time for them over the coming months as they start to get ready for it, start to prepare for it, start to get absolutely at their highest fitness probably for their lifetimes, and their mental state as well, their mental fitness as well will have to be the best in their lifetime as well. So I think the whole country wishes them well as they get those preparations underway, and very much looks forward to a very exciting time of soccer when we don't have it's completely controversy-free. If you compare it, say, to the World Cup that was just held in Qatar, there's none of that hanging over. It's simply pure joy for this nation. We're in it for a start, but also we're in it for the first time, and I think it's going to be a very, very exciting World Cup.
Okay, what's your favourite sport, Minister?
Well, that's a very good question. I mean, I think I used to do a fair bit of running, and I think I need to get back to that now to lead from the front as Minister for Sport. Similarly with the gym, I think COVID has interrupted me in terms of lifting weights, which is something I really enjoy doing, and again, it's something I'm getting back to now as Minister for Sport. I think I need to lead from the front. I would have over the years gone to, I suppose, a lot of soccer matches with my friends. But I suppose lately, sport in our house is really entirely revolving around my children. And that's, both boys play soccer, they both play Gaelic, and my daughter plays hockey as well. So we're heavily involved, I would say, in local clubs particularly. And that's where I spend almost every weekend for the last few years, is at various matches, driving from one to the other, trying to get bits of matches as well. So so I think I have a good experience of that level of participation.
I imagine you'll be going to a lot, I imagine you'll be going to a lot more matches now.
Probably, but the kids will have to come first, I think.
Okay.
When I tell the kids I'll be late for a match, I can actually see them sometimes looking at me from the pitch, like wondering have I arrived. So I think they'll have to stay as a priority. But that certainly is a good training ground for anybody who wants to get involved in this sector, because you see it at all levels.
Okay, over the course of the next year, what event will you look forward to most to attending?
Look, I mean, I think the ministers attend events all the time. I mean, and I did that as European Affairs Minister, and they're very, very nice. But I mean, if we're not getting increasing participation, if we're not increasing gender equality in sport, if we're not increasing participation by people with disabilities, it doesn't matter what events we go to or what sporting events we go to. They're the priorities. We've got to make sure, for example, that the national governing bodies have the 40% female representation. That's really, really important, and some of them haven't just got there yet, but they have to by the end of the year. That's what we'll be judged on. I go to soccer games, I go to Gaelic games, not being Minister for Sport, but as Minister, you're charged with actually delivering the policies and the government has set out, and those policies are really, really important. I think that's what I'll be judged on.
How do you believe this will impact on you politically, professionally? Is it a move sideways or is it a move upwards? You built up a very strong profile in European affairs, and while I'm sure you'll miss that job of work and indeed the profile that they gave you as a politician, there's great opportunity to build on that profile now in sport.
Well, look, I mean, when you're given a job as minister, I mean, the job is to, first of all, read into it and then do the job to the best of your ability. That's what I tried to do as Minister for European Affairs, and I had 2.5 years doing that, it was a huge honour to represent the country really at the highest levels across the world. I mean, I chaired the UN Security Council, so that was a particular highlight in that job. But sport is really, really important. I mean, the average family should be participating in sports every weekend, and that's daily life for people in Ireland. I think it's really, really important to get involved in. My colleagues, politicians across all parties place great value on sport. And already have been in contact with me about various issues surrounding sport. So I think it'll certainly keep me in much closer contact with people on the ground. But I would say this, I was shown one newspaper article about 2 weeks ago where the word coveted was used about two junior ministries. One was European Affairs, the other was sport. So I think that I should take that as a compliment. But what I'll absolutely guarantee is I'll do the job to the best of my ability.
Okay, as I say, I think some of your colleagues will be envious of the position that you've been appointed to. I'm sure everybody in government, though, will be very disappointed with the way the year is starting today and the HSE asking people not to go to hospitals if at all possible. There's going to be a tough few months ahead in the health services, it would seem.
There's no question about that. I mean, I want to be clear, though, as well. I mean, if you're seriously ill, you have to go to hospital. Particular hospitals will have particular problems on particular days. We've had a massive increase. I think every family in the country has probably seen this in terms of coughs and colds and coughs that last a long time. And people have been sick over Christmas. We've all seen that. People have tried to be, in my experience, be pretty sensible about that and to try and stay away, etc. And I think that's had a massive impact on our hospital service at this time. So look, I mean, we as a government want to work and support the HSE as much as possible. There has been some work obviously done to try and get some private hospital capacity, but clearly our doctors and nurses are under huge pressure. So look, those warnings have been given, but I don't think anybody has suggested that somebody is seriously ill shouldn't go to hospital or shouldn't ring 999.
Okay, well, thanks indeed for joining us this morning, Minister, and best of luck in your new role. And as I say, thanks for your time with us on the programme this morning. That's Thomas Byrne, who's a Fianna Fáil TD for Meath East and the newly appointed Minister for Sport and Physical Education.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
The funeral of Pope Emeritus Benedict is to take place on Thursday of this week. And we'll look back on a Pope that will be remembered in different ways this morning by talking to Father Iggy O'Donovan, who's an Augustinian priest. And a very good morning to you, Iggy, and thank you indeed for joining us on the programme this morning. Sad to see anybody pass away, but how will you remember Pope Benedict and his time as the leader of the Catholic Church?
Yeah, well, a mixed bag, I would say, because there were, if you like, two phases to Benedict's life. The first part, mainly in Germany, where up until the 1970s, where he was seen as a leading scholar. And I think friend and foe alike will admit that he was a leading scholar and a very brilliant mind. And ironically, very much associated in the 1960s with the reforming end of the church, the liberal end of the church. And listeners might be interested to know that his job at the German university at Tübingen, where he lectured with Hans Küng, Küng was the man who actually recommended him for the job. Interesting, given subsequent events. So his publications, his books, his writings and so forth, okay, they'd be for people more interested in theology and church history and that type of thing. But they were, generally, it's agreed, they would have been very learned, very deep, a very learned man, probably the most learned pope for many centuries. Mm. Now, indeed, some of them, he didn't have much competition, but nevertheless, he was a brilliant man. Later, he took on, if you like, a career in the church, mainly as cardinal in charge of the Congregation for the Doctrine of the Faith, the CDF, a body which I encountered once or twice in my time. Mm. And there, if you like, a new Ratzinger emerged, where he became very much the disciplinarian and very much the watchdog, particularly in behalf of John Paul II, who put him in that job. It wasn't a job Ratzinger wanted. He never looked for a job in the church at all. In fact, he always more comfortable at his desk. But once he'd gotten that job, he felt it his duty to rein in the excesses as he saw them. And unfortunately, the excesses came from one side of the church, namely the liberal reforming wing, and the right wing and the others who, in my opinion, had done much more damage were the ones he encouraged. And I have no problem with right-wing people, by the way. I like both to be in the church. Mm. The problem was with Ratzinger is that he wanted only one side, and clamped down very much on the minority, whom he saw as being, if you like, dissidents and so forth. So it's a mixed bag. Yeah. But a very brilliant mind, a very brilliant man, I will say that much.
An exceptionally conservative pope, I think it's true to say.
In some ways, he didn't have a honeymoon. He inherited from John Paul, who was in ill health towards the end of his life. Nevertheless, John Paul was an international personality. John Paul, if you like, was the Pelé. God rest him. He's buried today, I believe. He was the Pelé of the church. You know, he was seen as the star pope after a series of quite dull ones, especially Paul VI. Now, John Paul was an actor. He loved the crowds. He loved the people. He was energized by activity, travel, meeting people, meeting young people, meeting anybody. Loved sport, all that type of thing. Ratzinger wasn't into any of that. He was a shy man, basically, and he liked to stay at his desk. He wasn't very comfortable in crowds and so forth. And in other words, he liked to read his theology books, but the job was given to him, and he took it more or less in obedience. But certainly, he was traditional. He encouraged very much the bringing back of the rolling back of the reforms of the Second Vatican Council. Mm. He encouraged this Latin Mass society. God knows some real right-wing loopers there, some of them. But he encouraged all that type of thing. And the other thing, of course, we have to acknowledge is that he had to face one tsunami, an absolute tsunami.
He didn't face it very well, though, did he? This would be the issue of clerical child sexual abuse.
Sexual abuse, that's was such a sensitive issue and such an enormous issue it became. Now, okay, that was there for decades. That went back to the old days. Yeah. That went back a long time.
But it also went back to his time in Germany as a bishop, when he ignored complaints against...
The big difference was, Michael, attitudes had changed, and above all, media had changed, and social media had come on the scene.
But the Pope's history told us that he ignored complaints about four accusations of child sexual abuse.
I have heard that. Mm. I don't have the details of the case, but in that, that would have been back, say, in the 1960s, 1970s. Mm. And I would have said that probably the majority of his colleagues at that time mishandled that situation badly everywhere. I wouldn't pick him out for particular blame there.
Mm.
But nevertheless, it was the tsunami he faced. And I don't think Jesus himself could have handled it, because it was such an issue that it did more damage to the church than the Reformation, than any other scandal of any sort.
Mm. Come back to that in a moment. But when you talk about him being right-wing or conservative, he certainly was when it came to the role of women in the church, same-sex relationships and contraception. And as you say, his right-wing views led to disciplining those with more liberal views, people like yourself.
Yes.
And you were disciplined because of Pope Benedict's leadership, were you not?
Well, okay, he didn't take that decision personally. He didn't know me at all. Though we did meet on occasion, ironically, we did. But he wouldn't have known me from Adam. I was a very small fry. Nevertheless, he presided over an atmosphere where that type of oppression took place. Like, I have actually a document to the effect that the gross scandal and so forth I had given to the people of Drogheda, County Louth, and Meath too, I suppose, the LMFM, the whole area there, and that the scandal and whatnot that had been inflicted, that type of thing. Yes, I have a doc. So he created, there was an atmosphere there which led to that type of thing. Now, other colleagues, such as, say, Father Tony Flannery, Tony was silenced completely.
Mm.
And then, of course, Hans Küng, who was probably the greatest modern Catholic theologian, was stripped of his right to teach Catholic theology. But he continued in a secular university and continued to produce his works as a theologian, but not officially recognized. But yes, he did preside over that very repressive period, all right. But he inherited that from John Paul. But except John Paul, had a more appealing personality, a more popular personality, but was extremely traditional behind the scene. But I do accept, though, that the whole thing was clouded by the sex abuse scandal. Mm. The whole thing was covered by, and he inherited that, and I think he was way out of his depth there, as would most of us have been. I don't come down on him on that so much, but the other issues you mentioned, Michael, such as the women priests, which an issue which I would have no difficulty with. They are the majority of our church, the women. And the description of the gay LGBT people as being disordered. Now, okay, he was speaking philosophically when he used that term, disordered. But nevertheless, if you use that word in modern English to somebody that they are disordered, it certainly comes across as extremely negative.
All right. I think one of his...
And those people... Now, luckily, we live in a society now where the people themselves have spoken, and I'm thinking of the referendum some years ago here, where the majority of voters who actually were Roman Catholic, how they voted to reform those repressive laws. And you look back now on people like David Norris and others as champions of civil rights.
No, I know, but they're still shunned by the church, though.
A good record there.
But they are still shunned by the church. It's the same church that covered up clerical child sexual abuse and indeed Benedict's role in turning a blind eye or covering up was strongly criticised by many. His biggest critic was possibly the Taoiseach of the day, Enda Kenny here, who after the publication of the Cloyne report spoke about the rape and torture.
Enda Kenny on that one, probably no Irish politician and no Irish teacher had ever spoken quite like that.
But what he said about Pope Benedict was that the rape and torture of children... Sorry, Iggy. He said the rape and torture of children were downplayed or managed to uphold the primacy of the institution, its power, standing and reputation. Was Enda Kenny correct when he said that on behalf of the Irish people?
Well, I remember it was in response to the Cloyne report. There was a seeding sense of anger in the country. And the Taoiseach was speaking in that context. Now, as far as I was concerned, I was glad he spoke, because the Vatican and so forth, it was a dysfunctional, narcissistic place. And the mishandling of these cases, now, nobody would have done it perfectly. The state hadn't done it perfectly down the years. Nobody had. But nevertheless, For me, that speech by Enda Kenny was possibly the finest public speech since De Valera's reply to Churchill in 1945. So also, it reflects again the maturity of our democracy. And as we celebrate our centenary this year, that we are now, the Taoiseach was speaking on behalf of a secular modern democracy that didn't have to kowtow to croziers and bishops and mitres and all that went on before.
Cardinals and popes.
Okay, the issue that Enda Kenny was dealing with was a deadly serious issue, that of protection. But overall, quite apart from that, the fact that he said it, it reflects the general change in atmosphere for the better that was happening in this country. And the various referenda since have, the people have spoken clearly, and they've also shown how they are now able to make a distinction between your personal faith and public policy. Okay. And that's the way it should be, and I'm very happy with that.
All right, well, Pope Emeritus Benedict will be laid to rest on Thursday. We leave there for the moment, Iggy, and thank you indeed for joining us on.
Yes, and we may rest in peace. And Pele today as well.
And Pele, of course. Father Iggy O'Donovan, thank you indeed. I think what we'll do now is listen to a little bit of what Enda Kenny had to say as Taoiseach following the publication of the Cloyne Report.
The revelations of the Cloyne Report have brought the government, Irish Catholics and the Vatican to an unprecedented juncture. It's fair to say that after the Ryan and the Murphy reports, Ireland is perhaps unshockable when it comes to the abuse of children. But Cloyne has proved to be of a different order. Because for the first time in this country, a report into child sexual abuse exposes an attempt by the Holy See to frustrate an inquiry in a sovereign democratic republic as little as 3 years ago, not three decades ago. And in doing so, the Cloyne report excavates the dysfunction, the disconnection, the elitism that dominate the culture of the Vatican today. The rape and the torture of children were downplayed or managed to uphold instead the primacy of the institution, its power, its standing, and its reputation. Far from listening to evidence of humiliation and betrayal with St. Benedict's ear of the heart, the Vatican's reaction was to parse and analyse it with the gimlet eye of a canon lawyer. This calculated, withering position, being the polar opposite of the radicalism, the humility, and the compassion upon which the Roman Church was founded. The radicalism, the humility, and the compassion, which are the very essence of its foundation and its purpose. The behaviour being a case of Roma lacuta est, causa finita est. Except in this instance, in Cancola, nothing could be further from the truth. Cloyne's revelations are heartbreaking. It describes how many victims continue to live in the small towns and parishes in which they were reared and in which they were abused. Their abuser, often still in the area and still held in high regard by their families and their community. The abusers continue to officiate at family weddings and funerals. In one case, the abuser even officiated at the victim's own wedding. There is little that I or anyone else in this house can say to comfort that victim or others, however much we want to. But we can and do recognise the bravery and the courage of all of the victims who told their stories to the Commission. While it will take a long time for Cloyne to recover from the horrors uncovered, it could take the victims and their families a lifetime to pick up the pieces of their shattered existence, if ever they do.
That's the former Taoiseach, Enda Kenny.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Now, the new year begins, and again, Brexit, the Northern Ireland Protocol are in the news. The Taoiseach, as you've been hearing, is saying that what was proposed is too strict, and some concessions should be made to those who are concerned about their British identity in Northern Ireland. It's interesting to hear those comments today, following the comments of the former Sinn Féin President Gerry Adams to the Oireachtas Committee on the implementation of the Good Friday Agreement, and he says we should be looking at the prospect of an all-Ireland jurisdiction, a united Ireland, a reunited Ireland.
No Irish government to this day
has produced a strategy to build a new and inclusive Ireland and give effect to Irish unity. Now there's a mechanism to achieve this. The absence of Irish government planning is indefensible. It's incredibly short-sighted. What is needed is the full implementation of the Good Friday Agreement, including setting a date and preparing for the referendum on the future. And this requires inclusive discussions about the future to ensure that not only do citizens take informed decisions, but that the new Ireland which emerges when the Union ends is one in which everyone is valued and social and economic rights are upheld.
That's when the Union ends, if the Union ends, of course. Gerry Adams was speaking to the implementation of the Good Friday Agreement Oireachtas Committee. The chair of that committee is Fine Gael TD, Fergus O'Dowd.
Like in my own county, you know, Jean McConville, Tom Oliver, Captain Robert Norrie, they were all murdered. And I just want to make this point personally. Like, I'm a Republican, I'm a nationalist. The difference is that I always believed that human life was sacred and that political system was the system to work in. And I you know, that's my point. And I just feel that the bodies of the disappeared, the people we've met, you know, who remain today in unmarked graves, you know, and I appreciate and acknowledge that I think 16 of them, in fairness, they've been located, but there are still families awaiting closure. And I think if we're talking about peace and getting an outcome, that these families need closure. And I just wonder if there's anything additional we can all do to make that possible.
Well, I work with the Commission.
Sure, no, I accept that. No,
I work with the Commission. I meet the Commission regularly. I have travelled to the places where some of these unfortunate folks have been executed, shot to death, and buried. That should never have happened. There are ongoing efforts.
Sure.
Bad weather and so on, obviously, and it's subordinate. So what we can do is appeal once again that anybody that has any information whatsoever, even the tiniest little bit of information, which they mightn't think is important, is very important to the Commission. And we'll hopefully see the return of those whose remains have still not been found. And that's certainly my resolve. And the Commission itself has said that it's got the full cooperation.
Sure. The bodies are... look, I'm only just making the point, just from my perspective, what I feel will bring closure is any additional steps all of us can make.
And
I think that's a fair point.
There's nothing stopping you, Fergus?
No, but I'm talking about the point I was going to make is that like, these were human beings that were being buried, you know, and somebody has to know. You could never forget that, in my view. That's just my personal view. And I'm just saying that as an honest point, and that's really the difference. The difference is that I think that's never acceptable, ever. Sorry, I know.
And I are wearing our pins today for the families of the disappeared.
All right, that's an interesting conversation. I hope you agree with Gerry Adams, who was invited in to speak to that committee as one of the architects of the Good Friday Agreement. You heard also from Fine Gael TD, Fergus O'Dowd, who chairs the committee, and it was Fine Gael Senator Eimear Curry who we heard talking about the pins at the end of that clip.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Now, just some comments coming to us. Eric in Dundalk says, "Hi, Mike. The late Pope was innocent. He never committed a crime. He was a holy man. God bless him. Happy New Year, Eric." Thank you indeed. Maul, on the other hand, says, "Pope Benedict was a judgmental hypocrite." Very strong thoughts there from Maul. Thank you for that. Following our interview with the Minister for Sport, Thomas Byrne, text, a WhatsApp message from someone who says, great to hear that Thomas has been appointed to sport. I note that one of his priorities is to achieve the 40% of women on boards. And what about minority sports? There's little or no ladies taking part. How will they be treated, says our caller. Well, thank you indeed for that. I've just been handed a note from the HSE about Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital in Drogheda. If you're not feeling well and you're thinking about going to the hospital, as you've been hearing about all hospitals, maybe you can rethink that. The statement says that the Lourdes is currently experiencing unprecedented attendances at the emergency department. Urgent cases will be prioritised. However, if you are triaged as not being clinically urgent, patients will regrettably experience long wait times. Please be advised that the local minor injuries unit is open until 8 o'clock this evening and every day at the Louth County Hospital. And if your complaint can be treated there, that is certainly a far better place to go for you, because you won't be waiting so long, and for the hospital and other patients, because you won't be putting pressure on the hospital. Now, as you heard in the headlines, the funeral of Brian Reynolds is to take place in about an hour from now. He died in Our Lady of Lourdes Hospital on Christmas Eve after what appears to have been a vicious attack on him at his home in Rathmullen Park. We're joined by local councillor, Labour's Pio Smith, who's in studio. Good morning, Pio, and thank you indeed for joining us. There's a lot of theories going around this, but I think there's a consensus that four men broke into Brian's house and beat him with hammers. And whatever resulted in his death, that certainly was linked to it.
Yeah, absolutely. And I just want to give pass on my condolences to the family. It's a very sad time for all of them. But yes, by all accounts, this was an extremely vicious murder, and it's something that we've spoken about before, about the viciousness of and the evolving viciousness of attacks on people who are, you know, probably involved in gangs. Mm. And this is gang-related murder from everything that I can actually.
Yeah, well, that's the phrase I was interested in hearing, because it's not a phrase that the guards are using as yet. They haven't said that it's a murder investigation.
Yeah, and I mean, I'm picking up from what other people are saying as well, and by all accounts, it does seem to have some type of gang involvement, you know. Mm. And, we do have a problem in Drogheda with gangs and drug gangs, organised crime. That's a reality. And if people think that the feud is over, well, how we defined the feud a number of years ago is probably over, in terms of the fact that there was lots of shootings on the streets and that type of stuff. But what I believe is actually happening now at the moment is that people who have kept their head down over the last couple of years because of COVID and the increased pressure from national media and the Garda presence are now exerting themselves and looking to dominate the drugs market in this town.
Right, and you believe that this is in some way linked to this, because there's been a lot of theories going around about cigarettes being seized, dodgy cigarettes being sold in the shop, a debt of €30,000, and that some of the individuals involved in this attack on Brian Reynolds may be involved in local drug gangs.
Yeah, well, certainly that seems to be the information that's coming my way and the information that I'm picking up even from the national media. And I think, you know, it needs to be called out too. It needs to be said, because we do face serious problems in this town and I suppose in other towns across the country. Just because, like, we talked before about the number of houses that were burnt out or attempted to be burnt out over the last, say, 3 to 6 months. And that seems now to be a consistent trend that's happening at the moment. And I'm worried about what's happening in the town. I'm very worried about what's happening to young people in the town and where it's going to lead to. Because, you know, if people think that the drugs trade or the illegal cigarettes trade, and let's talk about legal cigarettes too, because, you know, this is a big trade at the moment. I mean, I remember times in the past where container loads of cigarettes were coming in through Drogheda Port and the customs were taking certain containers away. So this is a trade that's active in the town. And when people are buying illegal cigarettes and buying illegal drugs, they're fueling what's going on. And to some extent, there definitely is a connection between somebody paying for a box of cigarettes and what's happened there to Brian Reynolds. That's the reality of it. In my view, that's the reality of it. Mm. And we need to make that connection, because if we're not making that connection, we're losing out on something.
Yeah.
Do you think people will think about that if they open a packet of cigarettes that they bought for €4 instead of €14? I understand that's what you're hoping will happen, but people say, I can't afford the cigarettes, and you know, I had nothing to do with that.
Yeah, and that's the way some people think. It's certainly not the way I think. And my fear is this, that by using the illegal cigarette market and by using the illegal drug market, that we're actually eroding the society that we have and the values that we have as a society. And this thing takes place over a number of years. The extreme cases of it we see in Mexico at the moment. But look closer to home in Holland, where there was a report issued there by the World Bank a year ago stating that Holland was actually on the verge of becoming a failed state because of the influence of crime and organised crime. And I'm not saying we are near there yet, but we can do a lot now at this point in time to stop ourselves getting into a worse situation. But unfortunately, from what I can see, we're just as bad now with illegal cigarettes and illegal drugs as we were 5 or 6 or 7 years ago. Right. In fact, we're worse.
Right. Okay. That's a big statement and tells a story in itself, doesn't it? Because so much attention has come on Drogheda.
Yeah, we've said before that we've got the guards, we've got the resources, but there's only so much the guards can do at the end of the day. And, we as a society have to actually start paying attention to our behaviour and what we do. Mm. I mean, I'm sure there's people listening out here today who know people who buy illegal cigarettes. I'm sure there's people out here today listening to this conversation with us who know people who are using illegal drugs. And you know, we have to talk to people in terms of saying there is a personal responsibility here on each and every one of us to do the right thing. And we can't abdicate that responsibility. We can't say, well, it costs me €20 or €15 in the shop and I can get them for €4 down here. So that's, I'm all right, Jack. Yeah. Mm. It doesn't work that way.
Mm. Mm. Well, it's going to be hard to convince people of that because, you know, they're highly addicted to these things and can't afford to do otherwise.
Yeah, well, that's true. Yeah. I mean, cigarettes is probably one of the most extreme addictions people can get. I mean, when you say I'm going to give them up, to actually giving them up, the average time is 25 years. So it's really an addictive thing to get involved in. But the point I'm making is that certainly from a society point of view, from a government point of view, we have to look at how we're going to tackle this, because we're playing catch up at the minute. Mm. So we had no resources during the recession. The community policing units were stripped. We had no interventions in the community as such. Even now at the moment, if you look at the burnout rate in social workers in Drogheda, it's extremely high. And you've got younger people coming in from college and taking over complex cases.
Yeah.
So we have got a significant problem. And you know, we got to open our eyes to it and say, you know, when we look at Brian Reynolds' death or somebody else getting burned out of houses, this is what's going on. And we tend to push these things out of our head very quickly and move on with our life because we don't like to think about them. But should.
It's hard to understand how it's not being described as a murder investigation at this stage, given what is being said about what happened, that four people battered this man to death with hammers. And it's an atrocious murder. It's not on a normal scale at all. And coincidental, perhaps, that it's the second really atrocious murder in Rathmullen Park. But are there pockets of the town, like every town, like Moneymore, Rathmullen Park, where there is a greater problem, if you like?
No, to be honest with you, I think, like, you know, certain areas of the town get a bad reputation because of the way things are reported in newspapers. But there is a lot of people who are middle class people going around smoking weed on a regular basis, taking cocaine on a regular basis, and they have got a disposable income to keep this market on the go. And we never hear about this. You know, it's never really talked about. But I'm telling you now, that's a reality in this town. And so pointing the finger, I'm not saying you're pointing the finger, but the national media can point the finger at certain areas in Drogheda and say, oh, these are trouble spots. The best of people live in Moneymore, the best of people live in Rathmullen. And a small number of people who are involved create a bad reputation for the area. But the people who are actually fueling the drugs market in the town seem to get a free pass, in my view. And a lot of those people are people who are middle class and professional.
And they're fueling it because they're creating the market for the dealers, whether they're selling
Yeah.
Cocaine or cigarettes, they're the dealers, and they're heavy-handed gangs. And I'm sure you remember that famous quote from the Dons when they brought heroin into Dublin in the 1970s and said, if you think, Larry Dunn was saying, if you think we're bad, well, you see what's coming behind us. Is that the kind of territory that we're getting into in Drogheda now? That we're not talking about the same gangs or the same structures, but we're talking about a new posse as such?
Yeah, my own view is that there is a cohort of people who have formed a gang and are looking to dominate the drugs market in Drogheda. And I think that they're well on the way to doing that. And there is another rump of people who are probably against them to some extent. But, you know, that's where we're at. Mm.
And that's why the petrol bomb attacks have started again, is it?
I believe so.
Yeah.
I definitely believe so, yeah.
Yeah, they're telling people to get off our turf.
Yeah, yeah. Basically, that's what it's all about. You know, that's what it's all about. Mm. And it's going to continue. And like we spoke before about the viciousness of things, I mean, like, this is not going back 10 years ago where people would have a bit of a row with each other. This is evolving. You've seen what happened with Keane and Reedy Woods. You've seen what's after happening with Brian Reynolds. And there is a trajectory to this type of behaviour where it gets more and more vicious. Because people believe that they have to outdo what's after happening in the past in order to make a point.
Yeah, and they can act with impunity because everybody is scared of their lives at the moment. I mean, imagine somebody knows what happened to Brian Reynolds, but I'm not sure there'd be very many people who'd be brave enough to come forward and testify against those responsible for his death.
Well, if there was, as reported in some of the papers, four people involved in the murder, well, then you can actually be fairly guaranteed there's probably about 20 people know about it, have information about it. And I, you know, I would definitely call on people to get in contact with the Garda information, confidential information line, and give whatever information they have, because there's probably somebody that was involved in that murder who has regrets about doing it now. There are other people who have no problem with being involved in the murder, but there's probably some people who are regretting it, and their conscience is at them. And I would say to them, listen, you know, get involved, get to speak to the guards in a confidential manner, because this can affect the rest of your life in a very negative way.
Okay. Pio Smith, thanks for coming in to us this morning. That's Labour Party councillor on Louth County Council, Pio Smith.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
The highest number of deaths on Irish roads recorded in 6 years occurred last year. 155 people lost their lives on the roads, and the new Minister of State in Transport, Jack Chambers, is saying that he wants to reduce speeding, and that will be his main priority to try and see a turnaround in the trajectory that has seen the highest number of deaths, as I say, since 2016. Let's speak to Sinn Féin's spokesperson on transport, Darren O'Rourke, who's a TD for Meath East. A very good morning to you, and thank you indeed for joining us on the programme. The problem was a lot worse many years ago, and we've seen the numbers come down over many years, but we seem to be going back in the wrong direction.
Yeah, that seems to be the case, Michael, and the new junior minister has pointed towards one factor, and it is acknowledged as a major contributing factor in the area of speed. One of the others, I think, that is an area of focus from the RSA and others is the area of distraction, whether that be, you know, chemically induced drugs or alcohol or mobile phones. They are seen as major contributing factors towards road fatalities and also serious collisions causing serious injury. It is very concerning to see the rise. I think there's a number of factors that need to be considered. I think the roads are being used in a different way. Obviously, the return after COVID, you know, COVID has had an impact here. But also there's an increase in number of pedestrians using the road, and in the time ahead and in the years ahead, we hope that there will be even more pedestrians and cyclists and vulnerable users on our roads. And very concerningly, we see an increase in the number of fatalities of those road users as well.
Incredible, wasn't it? 41 pedestrians were killed last year.
Absolutely. And you know, we have to think of every one of those is a life lost and a mourning, grieving family and friends, and is avoidable. These are avoidable deaths in the absolute main. A lot of it related to driver behaviour. And I have to say, everywhere I go, whether I'm talking to stakeholders or whether I'm talking to grieving families at the transport committee, the one issue that comes up time and again, and it is the deterrent of the fear of being caught. The fear of being caught speeding or on your phone or drunk driving or drug driving. And that deterrent isn't there in a sufficient capacity. I've raised this in Meath with the Joint Policing Committee. Thankfully, I think our numbers, we don't have them absolutely confirmed, but they have slightly improved. We had a particularly bad year in 2021 in Meath. I think it has improved, which is welcome. But again, we need to reduce the figures there. And what we need to see is an increased Garda presence, checkpoints on the road. And we know that instead of meeting the target of 1,200 in the roads traffic unit, we only have about under 700 people in the traffic unit, and that's across the state. And there was a commitment there from the Garda Commissioner to get it up to 1,200. But instead of recruiting into the Garda, we're actually reducing numbers year on year, and that's deeply, deeply concerning, and needs to be addressed by the minister and acting minister.
All right, and is it a question of policing, enforcing the law, or is part of the solution education and teaching people, explaining to them so that they understand why the laws are in place, so that people's lives are protected, aren't lost? And if you look at the statistics that have been provided for this year, it seems that the majority of those who died on the roads were men and under the age of 35.
Absolutely. There's a pattern within it. And again, to make that point, that these are individuals, there are no two cases are the same. But to talk in the generality of road safety, anywhere where, and we have made significant progress, you said it, over years, it's a number of factors. So it's driver education, it's engineering solutions. It takes far too long to get traffic calming measures in urban centres and in rural settings. It doesn't happen quickly enough right across the board. It's the education piece. It's also the rules and regulations to ensure that our licensing system is fit for purpose, our NCT system is fit for purpose, the cars are of a standard, to ensure that, you know, the penalty point regime is enough of a deterrent that people are aware of it. But critically importantly, that there is enforcement. Because anywhere where there has been success in driving down fatalities and collisions, it has been that suite of measures. There's a plan in place by the Road Safety Authority, but there's that many plans, Michael. It's only implementation that matters. And we are failing considerably, particularly in terms of recruitment into the Gardaí, recruitment into the road traffic unit, and that needs to happen. It needs to happen as quickly as possible to ensure that, you know, that deterrent is there for people who are, for whatever reason, and you know, there's a particular, and I, you know, I was a young man before, and I, in my position as a TD for the area, as a male TD, to say to young drivers, you know, this life is, it's not a dress rehearsal, you know, this is, you get one shot at this. You know, when you're behind the wheel in a vehicle, it's not a toy. It's a, you know, they're incredibly powerful, incredibly dangerous, and there are risks associated with it. Far better to take your time and to exercise all caution, because you know, there are others dependent on your actions.
Okay, well, we are going in the wrong direction, but it has to be said that it follows many years of a reduction in the number of people who lost lives on Irish roads, and one of the reasons for that is something that you mentioned there, I suppose, the infrastructure, and indeed over the past two decades how cars have improved and are generally safer vehicles to be driving. But when it comes to the infrastructure, that is costing us and continues to cost us. Tell us about the €6 million that has gone to the operators of the M3 motorway toll booth.
Yeah, this is a feature of the type of contract that was entered into which essentially guaranteed the builders of the M3 motorway an income. So if the traffic volume wasn't to the requisite capacity, that the taxpayer would pick up the difference. So over the period of the last 2 years, €6 million has been paid. Over the course of the last 12 years since the motorway, the M3 came into being, over €18 million, that's exclusive of VAT, has been paid to the operator. And I have to say, at a time of a cost of living crisis, at a time when last year the M3 operator announced operating profits in excess of €11 million, that the taxpayer was picking up a tab and contributing €6 million over 2 years, it points towards the problem and actually the dreadful nature of the gold-plated contracts that were entered into back in the early 2000s. And it was Fianna Fáil-led governments that were very fond of these PPP contracts. And
delivered the roads, that is the other side of it. But what's the solution to it now? Because they are contracts, I'm sure you would want the government to honour those contracts.
Yeah, and I think, look, that's a difficulty. And we had the conversation, Michael, before the Christmas in relation to the toll increases and the impact and the prospect of them not going ahead, and the fact that there are contracts in place and contracts are contracts. I think one of the complicating factors in relation to this particular feature, and it's only in two places, in the M3.
Jack Lynch Tunnel, isn't it?
And the Limerick Port Tunnel. And the Limerick Port Tunnel, it's actually far in excess of what we're paying in Mead. They're in the region of almost between €7 and €10 million a year. And luckily enough, when we get back to significant traffic volumes, there were years there in 2018, 2019 where the taxpayer didn't have to make a contribution because the traffic volumes were sufficient. But it raises the question in the time ahead, and many people have said to me before, the reason why the Navan rail line isn't being built is because these gold-plated contracts were entered into on the M3, and the need cars on the M3 to pay for the M3. So you won't have the Navan rail line delivered, and I'm committed to ensure that that isn't the case. And I specifically asked the question and specifically got the answer that it wasn't the case. But you can see where there's a policy conflict there, where the less cars that are driving on the M3, the greater the bill that the taxpayer is going to have to pick up.
And this, and your theory is that people will be taking the train instead of driving.
Absolutely, and this contract runs out until 2052. So there are. It's something that does have to be considered. I think, we do have to live with it as it's part of a contract. But I think, it's important that as we look at a whole change in terms of transport policy, and we had the climate action plan before the Christmas, that we do review these contracts and make sure that they are. We've done it on other, we've done it on the M50, for example, in the past, and we ensure that they are fit for purpose for a new mode of our new approach in terms of transport policy, where we're encouraging people onto public and active transport. At the same time, we can't be heaping extortionate costs onto motorists who are forced to use the motorways, or onto the taxpayer for picking up the tab for dreadful contracts entered into by Fianna Fáil-led governments.
Okay, now I can see from the sheet that you sent to us that tab actually runs to €6,207,477 to guarantee payments to the operators of the tool, that money paid over 2 years. That's the way it is, and no way out of that one, it would appear, in the immediate future at least. But we leave it there for the moment. Thank you indeed for joining us as always. Sinn Féin's spokesperson on transport, Darren O'Rourke, who is a TD for Meath East.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Now, an awful lot of people have come to make Ireland their home, moving here from Ukraine, fleeing war. Many of them are very talented professionals. But what about all of these doctors, nurses, accountants, lawyers, engineers, or whatever their profession is and what they're doing now? There is a barrier because in some circumstances, their qualifications aren't recognised in this country. And indeed, in other cases, there are language barriers to them getting work in the professional field. This leaves a situation where they might get work as a cleaner or a translator or work in a bar or something like that.
Part 5 of the bill, Count Corla, deals with a separate issue, which is requiring the government to introduce regulations to give effect to the qualifications of people who have fled Ukraine. There are very many people who have come to this country, who are very welcome to this country, who have qualifications, whether that be as lawyers or doctors or as accountants. Those people want to work here. But at present, there's great difficulty in terms of them getting the appropriate qualifications and recognitions to carry out their area of expertise. Under Section 13 of the bill, there'd be a requirement on government to review that issue and to put forward proposals as to how we could recognise the qualifications that those people have.
Right, that's Fianna Fáil's Jim O'Callaghan, who introduced proposed legislation in the Dáil before Christmas, which could lead to some of those qualifications being recognised, although I'm not sure that it maps it out completely clearly. Let's speak to John Lannan, though, who's the CEO of Duras, which works with people coming into this country, immigrants from Ukraine and elsewhere. And a very good morning to you, John, and thank you indeed for joining us on the programme. What do you make of what Jim O'Callaghan is proposing?
Good morning. There's quite a lot in this Ukraine solidarity bill. The main part of it is, as you said, relating to the crime of aggression and putting that into Irish law. There's a part relating to sanctions that have been imposed by the European Union on individuals that are associated with the Putin regime. But the part that you're referring to there on foreign qualifications would require the government to introduce regulations to give effect to the qualifications to people who've arrived here from Ukraine. And I think this is quite welcome. As you've noted already, a lot of people are coming here with a lot of expertise, a lot of knowledge and experience that they can bring. There was a story in the Irish Times at the weekend of 6 doctors up in Donegal who hope to work in Ireland once their medical registration is complete, but for now they have to work as cleaners or in a bar. And in Duras, we've met several doctors, we've met psychologists, we've met psychotherapists, lots of others who want to use their skills, they want to use their training, but they can't because their qualifications aren't recognised.
I read that story in the Irish Times, and it really described what it said were the horrors of war in Bucha, and how some of these 6 doctors who are now in Bundoran fled from those bodies on the streets and the terror of war to find some sanctuary in this country. It must be difficult for them to come, though, not just under the circumstance of seeking refuge and international protection like that, but to a totally different life where their skills have no value. And I think that was reflected in that piece to a large degree.
Indeed. I mean, they are very skilled professionals. And one of the things that we have found over the years with people who came here seeking international protection from other countries is that over time, they lose their skills and expertise. It can become obsolete. You know, if you're working in a professional capacity, you need to be keeping up to date with developments. You need to be practicing. You need to be engaged all the time. And you know, we know, we recognize that it takes time and it takes resources to recognize the qualifications. Even simple things like the Ukrainian driving license has required specific processing. It was good that they're accepted in Ireland now, and that does help people to get access to work. English language proficiency, of course, is another area. It's often the first stumbling block. So we need to ensure that the education and training boards and others are resourced to provide classes. And not just a couple of hours a week, that isn't enough. What's needed is intensive courses to enable people to work here in Ireland in their professional capacity or in some other field.
Yeah, because it's easier said than done in a lot of respects, isn't it? I mean, you don't want to compromise the qualification, let's say, of doctors generally if the Ukrainian qualifications differ somehow and aren't up to the same standard. But apart from that, you have to have the language of the country to work in the country.
Absolutely, yeah. And there is, without doubt, a lot of work that needs to be done in this. I mean, in many ways, we've been able to react faster to the arrival of people from Ukraine than from other parts of the world. It is important to say that while recognizing Ukrainian qualifications is really important and it's welcome, measures like these shouldn't be limited to people from Ukraine. There are very many other people in direct provision with full or partial qualifications as engineers and doctors, radiographers, so on. They should also be recognised. So there is quite a bit of work to do here. It is complex. We've also got many people who have partial qualifications as well. So there needs to be pathways for them to be able to complete their training or their education. There is a role for the professional bodies here. There's a role for the universities. There is, as I said, lots that needs to be done.
Indeed. We start this new year with many of the challenges that we had last year. I think there's been some improvement, though, has there, in terms of accommodation with the latest appeal from government being heeded by some 500 property owners, I think.
Yeah, I mean, it is a welcome development that local authorities are now identifying, they're checking and they're making available any vacant units that come to their attention. But there is still an over-reliance on the hospitality sector, on hotels. You know, we know that, you know, when it comes to next summer or the run into next summer, a lot of the hoteliers are going to want to bring them back into use in the tourism industry, and that's perfectly understandable. So a lot more needs to be done in terms of providing longer-term secure accommodation around the refurbishment of buildings, the rapid builds, and all of that to ensure that the people who have had to escape from Ukraine, who've been here in Ireland now in many cases for 10 months since the end of February or the start of March, and who recognise that they are going to have to stay here for the foreseeable future. We need to ensure that they can integrate, that they can find a reasonable place to live, but that they can also enter employment, they can enter education, they can get on with their lives and ensure that their children can grow up safely here in Ireland.
Okay, well, I'm sure there's a lot of anxious people up in Dundalk at the moment. Around 50 Ukrainian refugees were told before Christmas that they would have to leave the Crown Plaza Hotel there and move to different accommodation in Kerry, in Galway and in Limerick. And they were heartbroken because they had their rooms in the hotel decorated for Christmas. They were saying that their children were in schools. They had jobs themselves and things like that, and couldn't understand how or why they had to relocate, let alone with such little notice. Now, a stay was put on that, and undoubtedly a decision will be made as to what's going to happen next in the coming days. But it's situations like that really need to be avoided, don't they? I mean, it seems so unfair, particularly on the children. And I read the other day that there's 13,000 pupils enrolled in schools since the Russian invasion on the 24th of February.
Yeah, it's very unsettling and difficult for people when they're moved, particularly at very short notice. And we have to bear in mind that the people who have arrived from Ukraine have already been kind of displaced violently in many cases. They've been traumatized by their experiences. They arrive in Ireland to find a little bit of security and sanctuary. Their children get into school, things start to settle a little bit. And then if they're uprooted from that can be re-traumatizing again. That can be extremely difficult. It can be unsettling for children and for the entire family. We've had many cases of people who had found work or had got into education and were doing English classes and were suddenly uprooted and moved. And we do need to get better at ensuring the stability and the well-being. This is another really critical area, is the well-being and the welfare of people in the accommodation centres right across the country. There are over 500 serviced accommodation centres for Ukrainians at the moment. We've got to ensure that there are adequate and appropriate standards across the board in all of those to ensure that people are safe and well.
And it was a record number of people who sought asylum in this country last year. I think it's about 70,000 people who have come from Ukraine, but over 13,319 people coming from other countries seeking refuge.
Indeed, and there is no doubt that this has put additional pressure on the Department of Children when it comes to finding accommodation, and the white paper that was proposed and committed to by government to end direct provision has to a large extent gone by the wayside now, although we do hope that they move forward with building reception centres so that people can begin the journey towards sanctuary, security and international protection here in Ireland. And again, just ensuring that they get what they need in terms of vulnerability assessments, addressing their medical needs, English classes, really important in order to be able to gain access to employment. But the numbers have increased significantly. And as I said, that does place an additional challenge on the Department of Children when it comes to finding secure accommodation.
Are there two categories of people seeking international protection, the Ukrainian refugees and everybody else?
So we have and have for several decades now had people coming here seeking international protection under what was initially the Refugee Act and is now the International Protection Act. We also have the people who are escaping from Ukraine who are provided with temporary protection, it's called here, under an EU mechanism. And it's really important to ensure that while we're putting positive measures in place for the people who have arrived from Ukraine and are welcome, and we hope that they can integrate and get on with their lives here. But we need to do the same for international protection applicants, people who are fleeing from persecutions and wars in other parts of the world, whether it's in the Middle East or it's an African country or it's some other part of the world, because they've also been, you know, been traumatized, been violently displaced, had really long, difficult journeys to get to Ireland, and it's taking a long time to process their applications. This is having an impact on the well-being and the health of people living in direct provision. It's causing stress, it's causing difficulties, and in many cases, because of the increase in numbers, we don't have adequately trained people in those direct provision centres right now either. And as a result of that, there are there are concerns over child safeguarding in many cases, over welfare, over well-being, and again, this is something that we hope the government will look to do in a better job on in 2023.
Okay. Indeed, some of the talents necessary may be available from those who are seeking international protection. And I think what you're saying, correct me if I'm John, if I'm wrong, John, is that if you you're a doctor who's come here from Syria, or if you've come here from Ukraine, that we should give people the opportunity to fulfill their potential and to look on it as an opportunity, and that there's a talent pool there that is possible to tap into.
Absolutely. There is a talent pool there, and it's welcome that there are employers around the country that are starting to recognise this. It's good that some of the people who have arrived to seek asylum or international protection here can work, but we need to ensure that people can work from the beginning of their time here, after they've acclimatized, one could say, they've got to the appropriate level of English. And we've got to do more, as you say, to ensure that qualifications from anywhere in the world are recognized. I mean, it's really soul-destroying for people who might have qualifications as a doctor, an engineer, a radiographer, to sit in a state of what's effectively like forced idleness in direct provision while the country is screaming out for people with their talents and expertise.
Okay, well, we'll leave there for the moment, John, and thank you indeed for joining us on the programme today. John Lannan is the CEO with Duras.
Michael Reid on LMFM.
Time now, as is usual, around this time on a Tuesday for our weekly visit to the Garda Crime Desk. As usual, there's a number of incidents Gardaí are investigating locally, and perhaps you can assist with those investigations. Garda Fiona Kerr of Navan Garda Station joins us for the report this week, and thanks for doing that. We're going to begin in Navan and a report of a car that was broken into.
Good morning, Michael, and Happy New Year to you and your listeners.
And
thank you. On Friday, the 30th of December, at approximately 6.30 a.m., an attempt was made to break into a parked car at Cushglasson Walk in Johnstown and Navan. The Gardaí and Navan are now seeking the public's assistance, especially if any resident has maybe CCTV footage or any motorist in the area has dash cam footage. So appealing to listeners this morning, if they have any information, to please contact Navan Garda Station, or indeed if they prefer to also, they can call the Garda Confidential Line on 1-800-666-111.
Okay, two burglaries then in Laytown to report on.
That's right. The Laytown Gardaí are investigating two burglaries which occurred last Saturday, the 31st of December. The first burglary took place in the Churchview area of Ardcath, sometime between 4.30 and 7pm. And the second burglary occurred in the Fenner area of Ardcath between 6 and 7.30pm. So anyone who may have been in these areas between these times and noticed anything suspicious, maybe any persons or vehicles acting suspiciously, they're asked to contact either Laytown Garda Station or Ashburn Garda Station.
All right, we'll go to the M3. You're appealing for information about some dangerous driving.
Well, in the early hours of the 1st of January, Gardaí received a number of calls from motorists reporting that a vehicle was travelling on the wrong side of the M3 motorway, and numerous Garda patrol vehicles were dispatched, and the Dunshaughlin patrol car met the offending vehicle travelling in the overtaking lane towards them. But they managed to bring the offending vehicle to a safe stop, and a male driver in his 30s was arrested at the scene and taken into custody. So the driver has since been charged with a number of road traffic offences and is to appear before Trim District Court. So the Gardaí did great work here, but we'd also like to thank the members of the public who reported this. And like with this incident and so many others, the Gardaí rely on the help and the goodwill of the public to help them do their job and bring offenders to justice.
Okay, very good. We're going to conclude with some advice that you have for listeners today about being web-wise.
That's right. So this Christmas, so many children would have received a new piece of technology, be it a phone, a laptop or a tablet. And if you need help setting up the parental controls, to check out the step-by-step guide on WebWise Ireland. And all of this information and lots more useful tips can be found on the Meath Garda Crime Prevention Facebook page. And just to add, a drone was found on the 26th of December and handed into Blackrock Garda Station. And if you think you could be the owner of this, to please contact dundalk.property@garda.ie. That's dundalk.property@garda.ie with further details.
Okay, very good. Thank you indeed, Garda Fiona Kerr of Navan Garda Station, and we'll return to the Garda Crime Desk in around the same time on next Tuesday's programme. Now, let's hear some of the comments that have been coming to us, and thanks as always to everybody who has been in touch with us. John is at Navan. He says he travels regularly to Dublin for medical appointments. Recently, he says he had reason to travel to Limerick on the motorway, and he's of the belief that if you're sticking to the speed limit, then you're seen as being in the way by other motorists. He says for the most part he travels at the speed limit and says that people fly past them at ridiculous speeds. No one seems to obey the existing limits. John says he doesn't really see the point in changing them further. On his numerous road trips over the last 6 months, he's never once come across a Garda checkpoint or seen a speed camera van in action. Thank you indeed, John. They are out there. I would imagine you've been lucky or unlucky, depending on how you view it, if you haven't come across one of the road checks. But they are out there, as we know from the reports of those who've been detected breaking some of the road traffic laws. Michael is in Bettystown. Thanks for your call, Michael. He says he wants to know if anything can be done about the large number of people who are popping on and off the footpaths on these electric scooters. Many of them are dressed head to toe in black, and there's little or no lighting or high-vis markings on their scooters. They're a huge danger on the roads and a danger to motorists. Surely it should be made compulsory that they have to wear high-vis gear when operating their scooters. Thanks, Michael, for that. It's certainly a problem. At least some people would say it's certainly a problem, and there's a lot of people who are very unhappy about scooters. I'm sure a lot of people got them for Christmas as presents as well, which could lead to some interesting behaviour depending on the age of some of the people who are going around on these. So there is legislation going through the Oireachtas very slowly. It doesn't look as though it's going to do anything much different for scooters that travel at speeds of 25 kilometres an hour or less. Another WhatsApp message from somebody who says, good morning, Michael. Myself and my family have moved into Kells, into a council house, but we've had no heating since it broke down. And I've a lot of concern about children and grandchildren. We'll put a call into the council on your behalf. Maybe we'll give you a call and get more details of that, and we can put a call into the council on your behalf and see if anything can be done about that situation. Obviously, a very unfortunate situation at this time of the year. Margaret, thank you for your text to the programme. She says, I'm a car driver and I'm fed up for being blamed for road deaths, and that it's the drivers who are always blamed. Yes, some are at fault, but so are cyclists and pedestrians who are out at night dressed in black but no lights or high-vis jackets or armbands, and they're very hard to see. Why aren't they prosecuted for being a danger on the roads? All road users, not just drivers, need to take responsibility for their safety and make sure that they can be seen. Thank you, Margaret. That's the final word for today. Thanks to Maggie McGuire, who researched. Chris Murray was on the control tower. I'm Michael. God willing, we'll see you for our next program tomorrow morning at 9 a.m. right here on LMFM. Good morning. Bye-bye.
The Michael Reid Show podcast. Tune in weekdays from 9 on LMFM. To contact us, email now, michael@lmfm.ie.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.